It's pretty clear that most organizations are in the risk of falling into what we metaphorically call a social trap. And a social trap is a situation where everyone in the organization knows that if you all collaborate in a generous and positive way, everyone will prosper, including, of course, also the organization as such. But if you find out that you cannot trust that most of your colleagues or the management play by these rules, it makes very little sense for yourself to play by them.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change Podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturluson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Heart Management. Values that don't get to cost us something aren't worth anything either. In the struggle between upholding the principles we say we believe in and a possible loss of prestige, convenience, or financial gain, our values get tested and too often found lacking. Like Carolyn Taylor so wisely said on this podcast many episodes ago, somebody who is values-driven is someone who lives by a set of principles which are strong enough to cause them to make sacrifices in order to uphold them. What would you be willing to sacrifice to act in accordance with your values? It's a really tough question to answer, right? And we don't really know until we're put in front of a situation where that matters. In 2018, Bo Rothstein gave up a coveted and well-paid professorship in political science at Oxford University. He did this because he couldn't teach political integrity and ethics with good conscience while holding a role paid by a financier who supported a cause Bo believed to be in conflict with the values that role represented. While Bo would be the first to say that he is no hero and he didn't need to fear financial or professional ruin, it still cost him something. Bo Rothstein is Sweden's leading political scientist. His long and illustrious career includes roles as visiting scholar and professor at well-known universities like Harvard, Cornell, and Stanford. For over 25 years, he held the role of August Röss Chair in Political Science at the University of Gothenburg. Bo has written countless books, including Just Institutions Matter and Social Traps and the Problems of Trust. Bo sees himself as an organizational scientist masquerading as a political scientist and is fascinated by the interaction between people and public institutions and what might build or destroy trust in that interaction. In our conversation, Bo shared the inspiring example of how the Swedish Tax Department became one of the most trusted institutions in Sweden by reframing its purpose and reshaping its culture. We will jump straight into my fascinating conversation with Bo as I asked him about the role of trust in building strong institutions and healthy organizations.
Very convinced, and there is a lot of empirical research also showing this, that also both public and private organizations, if they are going to perform well, trust between the staff and between the staff and the management is the key thing. And if without this trust, it's very difficult to actually steer and govern an organization in a good way. There is an idea coming from some rude economics that you can govern an organization just by incentives. So what the sticks and carrots. But the problem with this is that in order for the management to set the right incentives, they need information from the people who actually perform the work about what is complicated and not, what is quality and not. But if the people who actually do the work know that this information will be used against them to tighten their work situation or exploit them even more, they will never give the right information. And so there is no way out of this dilemma, except if you can create the type of trust showing that people who work in the organization, that if they give management correct information, it will not, they will not be mistreated. I can take, otherwise you will run into what is called a race to the bottom. I can take this from my own university. Many years ago, it was decided that the departments should get money depending on how many PhDs they produced. Classic incentive. The only problem is that those who set this incentive do not know what a quality PhD thesis is. Only we do that. And I could very quickly see that some departments, they increase the number of PhDs very much in a very short time. How did they do this? They did it by lowering the quality. So with this type of incentive structure that is not based on trust, you will come into a situation where the people in the organization, they compete in trying to destroy the most valuable capital of the organization.
I think that's really, really fascinating. And I think that ties into something when we look at ethics research, for example. We see that, I mean, in incentives, and if we look at organizational culture, I mean, culture is so much about the behavior that we encourage and that we reward, or the things that we kind of turn a blind eye to. And when you look at what drives unethical behavior, a lot of it is about bad incentives or that we tolerate the wrong things. But if we look at incentive structures, for example, I think in the sales force, that is a typical issue where you have like these huge bonus structures, which really incentivizes ruthlessness and kind of pushing past ethical limits and I think a lot of organizations are struggling with how do you actually do that in a good way. How do you then build instead of trust and motivate based on trust? And could you speak a little bit to that, of the research that you've seen or worked on?
It's pretty clear that most organizations are in the risk of falling into what we metaphorically call a social trap. And a social trap is a situation where everyone in the organization knows that if you all collaborate in a generous and positive way, everyone will prosper, including, of course, also the organization as such. But if you find out that you cannot trust that most of your colleagues or the management play by these rules, it makes very little sense for yourself to play by them. You don't want to be the only one in the organization who work very hard, or in the team if the other ones don't, or who play by the correct book or rules. So without this trust, it will be rational for the people in the organization to shirk, be engaged in various forms of misbehavior or corruption or whatever. And then you will come into a situation where everyone knows that if they could trust each other, everyone would do better. But since this trust is not in place, you will end up in a situation that is worse for everyone. This goes for basically people who study this. We think that this is the major civilization problem, actually. Most societies and organizations can suffer from this problem. Take a simple thing. Should you sort your garbage? Well, it makes sense if you think that most other people in your city are sorting their garbage in a correct way. But if you think the opposite, why should you put an effort in? Or take climate change. It makes very little sense to be the only country that actually do something about the environment. You cannot trust that all the other countries are pulling in. So this is from the very small group to basically global issues. This is the main difficulty in creating a well-organized and well-ordered society.
And I guess it's also an issue of kind of creating a well-organized organization in that sense, especially if let's say you're in a very large organization, and I think if we look at public organizations, which are or at least large public organizations, which are generally rather complex, and people work with so many different things, and you don't have a very cohesive group, maybe as you might have in a smaller company or something like that. So, what are some ways that you could actually then kind of create the trust that other people are taking, if we say taking that environmental responsibility?
Yeah, I have one clear example, although I do not have myself done the empirical research on it. It's when I speak to my colleagues outside Sweden or outside the Nordic countries, for example, here in France or in Britain or especially in the United States, that the most trusted public organization in Sweden is the tax authority. They do not believe what I say. But on a scale that can go from the minus 100 to plus 100, the tax authority is on the plus 64 level in our measures. So it's the most of we do surveys asking people in Sweden about their confidence in various public organizations. This was not always so. If you go back to the 1970s, we do not have any good data, but it's obvious that it was a very mistrusted organization. And then the tax authorities, listening to trust researchers, not only me, but many others, decided to change. And they made three important changes here. One was to try to change the internal culture, so they should not understand themselves as an organization chasing tax dodgers. They should see themselves as an organization trying to help people pay the taxes they were supposed to pay. So they changed from a sort of more police organization to a service organization. Secondly, they transformed the tax system so it became much, much simpler, much more transparent. Most Swedes today report their taxes by sending in a text message to the tax authorities saying, yeah, the figures you sent me are okay. So it's utterly easy. And they also took away many, many loopholes and deductions you could do and so on. And then, of course, there was also a change of the tax system. We had some taxes that were generally seen as very unfair, very, very high marginal taxes, and some property taxes that were difficult. So they made deliberate changes, and the result is very clear. Of course, there is people who do not pay the taxes that they are supposed to pay in Sweden, but the I guess that it's a country where the tax dodging is much lower than in many other countries. But the most interesting thing is the very high trust that the tax authorities in Sweden have. And this is a deliberate change. They have actually written about it. There are many, many other examples also from small organizations. This is also a reason, I think, why we see huge differences, because there are other agencies in Sweden that are not well trusted. I don't think it's because they are engaged in corruption, but basically because their decisions are very non-transparent. It's the labor market authorities, and it's also the migration authorities. So it's not the case that Swedes in general have confidence in all public organizations. There are huge, huge differences here between different public authorities.
And I love that example about the tax department, and I think what they managed to do was really, I mean, redefine their purpose in that sense. And I think they defined it something like that kind of we exist to help every Swede kind of do the right thing, and I think that's something that actually a lot of Swedes kind of know that saying in it. And I think because a lot of times when you hear an organization's purpose or value statement, you kind of immediately roll your eyes. But when I hear the tax department say that on themselves as their vision, then I feel, yeah, that's kind of right. They're actually making it easy for us to do the right thing or to pay our fair share. I'm thinking about that and thinking about that kind of culture change and what it actually took to be able to go through something like that in such a big organization where you also have, I guess, a lot of people who have very much kind of ingrained a way of thinking about who they are, why they do what they do, and so on. And I'm just thinking, what are some things that you think maybe has been kind of key in that, in being able to do such a transformation?
I think it's several things. First, that the leadership of the organization is very, very important, that they understand this problem and are willing to take measures. It's very difficult for a researcher like I to write the blueprint recipe for every organization, because every organization is different, but we can come up with some general theories that can be applied to the specific organization. The second thing is that there has to be what we call a functioning social contract. And the social contract is an idea, it goes way back in history, but it's an idea that there is an implicit contract between the state and citizens that the state is actually delivering what it has promised to deliver in terms of services and police protection and defense and whatever, pensions, in a way that people feel that they is free from corruption and various forms of favoritism. In return, people are supposed to play by the rules, follow the laws, and pay their taxes. And without this social contract, it's difficult to get the system working. There is also a third thing, that in the Nordic countries, you get the middle class on board here, because the middle class also get something out of it. It's social policies, social services are not only for the poor or the marginalized. And it's very, very important that you have the middle class on board. I think this was the main problem in Brazil with their Bolsa Familia, for example, a very good program, but the middle class was not aboard. And this is very much the problem in many, many countries where you try to do policies only for the poor, and then you will run into two problems. First, the middle class will not be included, and they are the swing voters, and that is also where the money is. And secondly, you get into a lot of implementation problems if you are going to target your social policies only to the poor, because the bureaucrats have to make two very complicated decisions. First, who is poor and who is not poor? And you know, this can be manipulated from both sides. And the second, if poor, how much? Well, if you take in Sweden, both rich and poor families get the same amount of money in child allowances. They are supposed to get the same quality of healthcare and go to the same healthcare and pensions and so on. So it's very important that this social contract includes broad groups. It's not only directed to marginalized. And I think this was, although I admire him for other reasons, this was the main problem with many of the Bolsa Familia programs in Brazil and in rest of Latin America.
This is such a fascinating topic. And I think as our our listeners are hearing you, I think that there are things that we can draw from this even to organizations and just thinking about the importance of equity within an organization and that people do not feel left out. And if we are to create contracts of trust, but I wanted to shift focus a little bit, and we might have time to come back and talk a bit more about trust. But something else that we talk a lot about on this podcast is values driven leadership and integrity. And I think it's very easy to think of values as some inspirational words. However, I used to say that values that aren't allowed to cost us anything aren't worth anything either. And in 2017, you made a decision that was costly. You held a really coveted professorship at Oxford University that you decided to leave. Tell us a little bit about what happened and why.
Yes, it was an interesting situation. I got offered a job as the Blavatnik Chair of Government and Public Policy at the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. And as you say, it was a very prestigious, and I can also say well-paid position compared to Sweden. And I was very happy there the first 1.5 years. I had great students, great colleagues, and Oxford is, of course, a hub for all kinds of intellectual occasions going on. So, but the name of my chair, name of the school, came from a philanthropist, Leonard Blavatnik, maybe the richest man in the UK and one of the richest men in the world, who have donated a fabulous sum to the school. Some 70 million British pounds, which in the social science is a phenomenal amount of money. And everything was well until I got information that he had started to donate money to Donald Trump. And my research, my teaching at the school and in general has, of course, been very much about the ethics, integrity, anti-corruption, good governance issues. And in my word, Donald Trump stands for exactly the opposite. The motto of the school was a world better governed. And I took up this issue with the leadership of the school and said, this is problematic. But they didn't think it was problematic at all. They said, what he is doing with his money, it's none of our business. And I said, if he would donate to some Nazi groups in Eastern Europe or to Ku Klux Klan, wouldn't that be a problem? But so I came into a situation where I found it impossible to stand in front of 120 students teaching and all my colleagues preaching what I'm preaching about importance, and at the same time they would ask, yes, and who is financing your position? So unfortunately, I came into this conclusion that I couldn't stay at this position. I had the name chair, so the name Blavatnik was stamped on my forehead. It was not my intention to take any big fight with Oxford University. It was a very personal decision because of my teaching and research. Had I been doing standard economics or election studies, I may not have taken this decision. So that is why I left. Now, I'm not a big hero here. It was very easy for me to go back to my university in Sweden and continue. So I didn't pay a very high price for this. I'm not a big hero on this. It was a personal decision that I didn't want to be connected to the support for Donald Trump. And I think after what he did in January 2016, I was proven right. He is not a person, a school that is have the motto, a world better governed should be connected.
No, so, and I think this really points to the heart of the issue when it comes to being values driven, if we use that term, that there are the points that where it costs us something. I mean, whether you say you didn't pay a high price, so I mean you weren't, but you did pay something. And I think that, I mean, in terms of prestige, in terms of just the thing of being disliked. I mean, I think all of us, we want to be liked. We don't necessarily want to bring up issues like that. And I think we see that issue now in a lot of organizations. And I think a lot of organizations now are navigating some really tough problems in that sense, from that perspective of what is this actually going to be allowed to cost us. I think we have now, examples of companies, let's say, like McKinsey or companies with or advertising agencies and so on, who are in one sense kind of holding up that we're standing for certain values when it comes to the environment or to ethics or whatever, and then on the other hand, working with companies and so on that are kind of pushing very different agendas. And I mean, we see like McKinsey's involvement in the Purdue Pharma scandal. And I think these are, of course, incredibly complex issues to navigate. But is there something that from your experience that you think these are some kind of good guidelines for leaders as you navigate these type of challenges and decisions, which might not be that black and white?
Yeah, it's very easy to sit on your high horses and lecture people about this. My rule is pretty simple. You shouldn't do things that you cannot defend in the public debate. Don't try to hide it. You should, that can be pro and cons for various positions, but you have to find a way that where you can defend what you do in front of the public. So if you are on the front page of New York Times or the Swedish Dagens Nyheter, you should be able to defend your decisions and come out in a ethically defensible position. If not, you are on thin ice. That's how I think about it.
And I think, since you referred to the Old Testament before, I'm referring to a quote from the New Testament that I think of that says that, like, everything that is hidden will be brought to light. And I guess that type of mindset is maybe perhaps what we need more of.
Yeah, I mean, I find that many companies now take this, they call it corporate social responsibility and anti-corruption, very serious, because they've seen what happened to companies that are caught with their fingers in the marmalade, as we say in Sweden. So I've been a little engaged with the World Economic Forum's group for anti-corruption, and I'm quite impressed by how seriously leaders and high-level officials in big international companies now take these issues about anti-corruption, and I guess also about the environment.
And so I wanted to connect a little bit to that, because, I mean, there's recently been a lot written about the Swedish telecom giant Ericsson and their involvement in yet another corruption scandal. There's been some before, and again, I'm not wanting to kind of throw dirt on them, because I mean that's something that I think most large organizations in some way have had these issues. But when Googling Ericsson and corruption the other day, my colleague found that 9 of the 10 first search results were articles about the corruption allegations. And the only other result was a page from Ericsson's website that said, "We have zero tolerance for bribery and corruption. This is embedded throughout the company." And I equate this statement with what many companies and public organizations kind of promise on their website, that say that these are corporate values and they guide all behaviors in the organization. And I'm looking at this, and I believe personally that this is, and in my work, I've found that in almost every case, when you look at a scandal and so on, you can see that they have held on to a self-image of being a good organization with fine, great values. And then they've tried to protect that information. They tried to protect that reputation and that self-image. So whenever information that has come up, that or allegations or concerns, they've kind of wanted to shoot the messenger and so on, to kind of protect this image. What's your perspective on that?
I have a more optimistic view about this. And that is, my time frame is a little different. If you go back to the 1980s, no one talked about corruption, not in academia, not in international development studies, not in the business community. In many cases, you could deduct bribes as a kind of commission and so. And also in the public, it was basically a non-issue. Very, very few were engaged in both academia and in especially in international development and aid. It was like a taboo thing. That has changed dramatically. So it's talked about. They employ people who are supposed to handle this. They educate their personnel. So the awareness is dramatically changed. Now, nothing is perfect, of course. I mean, even in a country like Sweden that has quite low corruption, we could never think of a country without corruption. That would be as likely as a country without crime. It will never happen. But there are huge degrees in this. And also, if you see in a time frame, when I started to think about these issues in political science some 25 years ago, it was a non-issue. And now it's a big issue. So that is changing in a very positive direction. And you can see from what is happening in Russia, I mean, one thing that happened in very corrupt countries is that you get the very politicized recruitment of civil servants, high-level civil servants. Now, what do? They only feed the political top man with the information that they think he wants. And you can see this has clearly happened when it comes to Putin. He thought that if he would invade Ukraine, they would give up in 2-3 days. He was sitting on completely distorted information because of the corruption in his administration. And also you see the enormous corruption in the military. One reason that they cannot fight is that they do not get equipment and supplies in time. And that is, of course, also because much of it is stolen or just sips away from them. So this is, you actually see the devastating effect of corruption in the Ukrainian situation. Now, but from a Western perspective, I'm a little more optimistic because I've seen this dramatic change in the awareness, the amount of research, the engagement in anti-corruption over the last 25 years. That is a thoroughly dramatic change. I mean, I'm from a department that like to measure, and you can actually measure this. You can see that in 1992, of some 60,000 published academic articles, only about 85 have the term corruption as a keyword or in the abstract. Today is about 3,000. So you can see the dramatic change also if you try to measure this.
And so I guess that the awareness of the issue and that you're actually naming it as more of a problem and understand the how it drives so many other problems in society has actually led to positive development.
Yeah, the problem is that we have not been very successful from the international level so far in coming out with good policies that could, get corruption under control. And this is mainly because I think, and this is in my latest book, my argument, this is because anti-corruption has been based on a theory that is very ill-equipped for handling corruption issues. And this is a theory built on incentives. It's known as the principal agent theory. And it's a good theory for understanding other things, but for understanding how to deal with corruption, it's based on a serious misunderstanding of the basic nature of it.
So I wanted to connect back again to this idea of values-driven leadership and leadership in general. And I was in communication with a well-known social scientist, Jonathan Haidt, and we've been trying to schedule an interview. So Jonathan, if you're listening to this, we need to make it happen. But and he's currently writing on a book that is really seems really fascinating, that it calls Life After Babel, and there's a public website, so I'm not saying anything secret. But in it, he's critiquing the current cultural climate driven in large part by social media. And I'm going to quote something that he's written there, and then I want to talk to you because you've written an article on something similar. But I think it paints the picture in such a great way. It says that, imagine if every person in the world was given a shiny high-tech dart gun and the ability to shoot a small dart into the flesh of anyone in the world instantly and with no risk of retaliation. Imagine if some people, activists on both sides, lived in communities that paid them a dollar for every dart they shot. Everyone would live in fear. Leaders who would be the most popular dart targets would become especially skittish. And you made a similar case in a recent article in the magazine Focus, that the current climate creates scared leaders. And I'm thinking, as we're talking about values-driven leadership, I'm thinking that fear is one of the most powerful drivers that hinders us from actually standing up for our values. So what's your perspective and what should we do?
I think there are two things. I think Haidt is right. And I think there are two things one should do. I do not do much social media at all. And I do not communicate. I do not blog. I do not. I don't have Twitter. I have only very, very few and very personal friends on Facebook, and that is because I do not want to communicate with people who can communicate with me anonymously. If you can communicate anonymously, you will send out tons of bad things because you do not have to take responsibility for what. The second thing, this article you mentioned, I think it's a problem with Swedish journalism and maybe journalists generally, that they, if there is criticism against the leader of an organization, and we had a very sad experience with this, with a theater director in Sweden who was the victim of a journalistic cabal, you can say, where they only listened to people who were critical of him, but not of the many who didn't report on the people who were not critical of him. And of most importantly, they didn't, when they heard this criticism from people in the theater, they didn't try to verify if it was correct, if it had any factual backing. Now, this ended with him committing suicide. Utterly sad. There are many others. So I think it's a problem with modern journalists that they take, people say, I'm discriminated, I didn't get the fair chance, I wasn't respected. And so they take this at face value. But a journalist, and there is no sort of impartiality in their way to say, is there any facts behind this? And if leaders of organizations fear that this is what can happen to them, they will, of course, be very, very not change-oriented. Because if you go in a change organization and in a specific direction that you believe in, there will be people in the organization who are not happy with your decision, even if they are necessary and the correct and very creative decision. You will get leaders who are very afraid of making changes, very afraid of standing up for new ideas, very uncreative. And that is a fear that I think this combination of social media and this, I think, very sloppy journalism can create.
I think that you point to, I mean, one thing perhaps that we need to be careful about what mediums we are a part of, that having a very large platform also kind of invites. And I think criticism can be really helpful. But like you say, when it is anonymous and when it is not verified, of course, it can be also incredibly hurtful. And I think another thing is perhaps what I think you alluded to as we were talking about your decision to leave Oxford, that it is, I guess, to really be very based in your values, to really be based on what are the things that I really truly believe are important and what are the things that I'm ready to go to bat for and pay a price for, and what are things that are maybe not necessarily that important to me.
As you said, we're running out of time, and so am I. We'll have some guests soon.
Absolutely.
So this was a very nice conversation. Thank you very much. Let me know where I can listen to the final thing.
So, Bo, thank you so much for taking the time.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we've received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.